Blog Talk Radio.
This episode of the best HR radio show in the world, HR Happy Hour, is sponsored by Acquire. Understand the true impact of your workforce investments by visualizing talent trends and the business events that influence them. Now with predictive analytics, Acquire Insight, more valuable than ever. Find out more at acquire.com/workforce analytics.
From Las Vegas, to quote my friend Eric Weingartner, with a slightly emptier wallet, a fuller belly, and a slightly compromised liver function, but we're back. HR Happy Hour is really happy to be back online. My name's Steve Bowes. Thanks for hanging out with us tonight on the HR Happy Hour show. We've got a great show lined up for you tonight, one that will, after it's over with, I promise you, you will think, boy, I don't really believe they hardly prepared for that show. It was so good. So I think you're going to enjoy the show tonight. We're going to be talking Moneyball, talent, sports. We've got a few members of the eight-man rotation crew in the house that will join us in a few minutes. So we're really pleased you're with us on the HR Happy Hour show tonight. So some logistics, as always. The HR Happy Hour show is recorded live. Tonight's episode number 120, by the way, is being recorded live on Thursday, October 6, 2011. Our call-in number tonight, 646-378-1086. And if you're following on Twitter and hanging out with us and listening and you want to jump into the back channel conversation, we hope you do. Our hashtag, HR Happy Hour. Keep an eye on that as well tonight. I feel like the Vegas is still, we've still got all that Vegas gravelly voice going on from the events of the last few days, and we certainly want to talk about that as well. In fact, before we even talk about in the HR space, the HR Technology Conference and HR Evolution, just briefly, because we spent a lot of time on this show talking about both those events in the last few weeks, I'll just bring our guests right on, because they were both present at HR Evolution and HR Technology Conference, so more better to do a little recap of those events as well. So let's bring on two more of the members of the eight-man rotation, which is odd because the eight-man rotation, and we'll talk a little bit more about that, is really only five people right now. But two more of the guys are with me. First of all, welcome back to the HR Happy Hour, Mr. Lance Hahn. Lance, how are you tonight?
Steve, great. Still... got that Vegas in my throat a little bit. It's gravelly. I still feel like I'm tasting a little bit of that smoke, that processed smoke taste.
Yeah.
Can't get it quite out of the system, but yeah, I'm getting there.
There's nothing like an early morning walk through the casino, heading down to the conference, 7:30 a.m., getting a jump on things, right? Getting down to the press room, perhaps, to get an early start on your meetings and briefings, and you hit that casino floor, and boom, there's like the four or five old ladies smoking hard on the slot machines, working it, and you just boom, you encounter that like right off the elevator. I'd love that. That's just bracing in the morning.
Exactly. That's exactly the experience.
Yeah. So, well, Lance, man, great. We'll talk a little bit about the show as well before we get into the Moneyball stuff. And also with us, the creator of the Eight Man Rotation, our ebook. We'll have to tweet out the link to our ebook, which is a great little thing Matt Stalick put together. Please welcome back to the show, Matt Stalick, also known as Bruno, aka Bruno. Matt, how are you tonight?
Doing well, a little jet lag. I think the I think the taste in Lance's throat is either Virginia Slims or the In-N-Out burger he had on Tuesday.
Yeah, that's a great look, you know. Drop a little
Virginia
In-N-Out
Slims.
Burger. Yeah, yeah, a little Virginia Slims action. That's great. That's great. So, Matt, thanks for joining us tonight. So, hey, since I've got both you guys on, let's just talk for a real quick second, HR Technology, HR Evolution. It was a great few days. Any just quick, you know, maybe 60-second thoughts. I'll go to you, Lance, first. 60 seconds on HR Tech and HR Evolution.
Great. I mean, great two events. Back-to-back was actually probably the biggest challenge. HR Evolution by itself is a big event, a big one-day event to take in all at once. And then going straight into HR Tech was just like double pow. But lots of good information shared, different crowds at each one. So HR Tech was, as usual, a very big, large show. Lots of people there that you don't get to see at the traditional HR shows. So that's why I love going to it.
Great. Matt Stalick, your thoughts, and in your recap, your 60 seconds, please do allow a few seconds to talk about your amazing run of luck betting on college football games that I witnessed.
Well, I went 19-3 over the weekend on college and pro football with a little Brewers.
Do you have like a 1-900 line you're going to give out to start selling
I'll change
picks?
My name to AKA Tout a little later.
Yeah,
on.
19-3 is quite
19-3.
Impressive.
Which I knew that in advance. I might have put down a few parlays and really cleaned up.
Yeah, yeah, fantastic.
But, your
thoughts on the events?
First time being on the planning committee for HR Evolution, so it was nice to see it from that end and sort of get the behind the scenes of how it's put together and the work that goes behind it, and really got to give credit to you and Trish McFarlane and Ben Eubanks on your Herculean efforts over the past few years putting the event together.
Yeah, Matt, well, thanks for that. And, of course, thanks for all your help in putting together HR Evolution. It was a really good event. And, we're not going to belabor it. There's been lots of blog posts written so far about both events and more to come, I'm sure. So super events. Just some quick rounds of thank yous on that. Of course, thanks to the Bill Kudyk and everybody at HR Technology Conference and LRP for helping making HR Evolution possible at LRP. Of course, thanks to our show sponsors, Acquire Software, as always, for all their support. Continue to be with us for a long time now, so we really appreciate everything those guys do. Mark Stelzner back in the house. We saw him over the weekend, and he managed to take a break between plane flights, I think, today and record the spots for today's show, so I appreciate that as well. So, yeah, it was a great time in Vegas. I really had a good time. I think, Lance, for me, you were there, too. One of the highlights of the week was the dinner we had with the boys on Tuesday night, right, as we were that sort of guys' dinner in Vegas, the 8 or 9 guys, you know, having steaks. It was sort of like an Ocean's 11 kind of vibe, but sort of like the sort of unattractive, you know, balding, you know, paunchy version of Ocean's 11 we had. It was fun.
Yeah, no, it was the, you know, we got dropped off a mile away from the steakhouse, and then, you know, had to, like, hike our way through, you know, those Virginia Slim smokers, retail shoppers to get to the steakhouse, getting lost in the process.
Right.
Sonar 6 had a call like 3 times for directions, right?
Yeah.
Right. But no, yeah, great, great dinner, of course, and a good conversation. Not a lot of that conversation could be made public, though. I mean, I think there was a lot of stuff that was talked about that was untweetable, unbloggable, which is always
fun.
No
kidding. That's such an inside show. So we better get off of that before we get into any trouble about that dinner. So hey, let's talk about what we wanted to talk about tonight. Quick reset. This is the HR Happy Hour show. My name's Steve Bowes. I'm joined by 2 of the 5 members of the 8-man rotation, sports and HR talent sort of subculture mafia, if you will. Lance Hahn from ERETLNT, you know him well, and Matt Stalick, a.k.a. Bruno, the professor. So we've got the guys on. We want to talk Moneyball a little bit. First off, I'll throw it out to both of you guys. Have you actually seen the movie yet, Moneyball? I haven't actually seen it. I've read the book, but not the movie. You guys, either of you seen the movie yet?
I haven't.
I'm not. I'm not a movie guy, so I don't usually go watch movies. Lori Rudiman, who watches the movie like every week, has seen it and told me it's actually very good. She enjoyed it, which is saying something. She's not a sports fan, so.
And Matt, you said you did see the movie?
I have not. With planning for HR Evolution and coming out to Vegas and our state conference coming up next week, movie time has been cut off. Plus, I had to plan for my betting in Vegas, so.
Right. Okay.
Kind of
so
preparation.
That's cool. So we'll go Moneyball from the perspective of the book and then the topic more broadly. So yeah, I know we've all read the book and sort of and why Moneyball's in the news and why we're talking about it, of course, was the recent movie, which was, I think, pretty successful as movies about, you know, backroom, you know, baseball dealings would go. It wouldn't seem to have that kind of appeal. I guess Brad Pitt helped out on the appeal side to make it a more mainstream, but I mean, I'll just throw it out, Matt, to you first. You know, we talk about Moneyball, and we're guessing everybody knows the story, but maybe for anybody who's listening who might not know the basics of the story, I wonder if you could maybe just give a minute or two on what the point of the story was about.
Sure. Basically, we are comparing money teams like the Yankees, the Boston Red Sox, who have a ton of money, spend oodles of money on payroll to get the best players, which creates inefficiencies in the market. How do small market teams like Oakland or Kansas City compete when they spend far less given their resources? So they had to look for new ways to compete. And Billy Beane decided that outs were precious, looked at players that were underappreciated in the market, and put together players that were cheaper, but were much more efficient. The key statistic that is often used is on-base percentage. Whether
right.
they get on by walks, hit by pitch, hits, the more they can get on base and not make an out, the more efficient the team will likely to score runs and be successful. And so Oakland had a number of very successful seasons over the years, although never succeeding in the playoffs. They were able to compete successfully despite that smaller payroll because
right.
of using those statistics and using those approaches in creating and exploiting those inefficiencies.
Right, and the really interesting thing, whereas right, you baseball and statistics and detailed statistics about baseball have existed for over 100 years, right? Baseball is probably the most measured and studied sport from a statistics and analytics perspective ever, and that's not new, right? Lance, like when Willie Beane and the A's decided to start looking at on-base percentage or walks and hits over innings pitched, say, on the pitching side, those statistics had been around forever, so why had other teams not really focused on them before?
Yeah, I think you get stuck in these things and you evaluate players on the same basis for, I mean, they've been around, but they haven't really been used in analyzing that. I mean, you're still looking at RBI, stolen bases, hits as the primary way you're evaluating whether somebody's a good player. And the whole rise of the sabermetrics was kind of a response to that that says, you know, you find a lot of great players that maybe don't look so great in those key areas, but like Matt said, I mean, you get on base the most, or you have my favorite is the wins above replacement, you know, that those
right.
sorts of measurements where you know, it does take a little bit more statistical analyzing, but that's really what gives you the edge up, especially when you've got a payroll that's closer to Pittsburgh than the Yankees. That's what you've got to deal with.
Yeah, and so by changing it's not so much inventing new analytics, because they did a little bit of that, but right. But at its core, it's more about looking at the game and looking at the drivers of success, right, for a team differently than the other teams were looking at it, and certainly how sort of popular culture or popular fans would look at the relative value of players, right? A perfect example would be, you know, a slugging hitter. You know, some hitters, right, they slug lots of home runs, they don't do anything else, and they strike out a lot. You know, they might be but they've hit a lot of home runs that might be valued publicly and make a lot of money based on the fact that they've hit a lot of home runs, but they're really killing the team, and the team might be better off with a guy who's maybe not hitting as many home runs, but is just really getting on base a lot, hitting a lot of foul balls, taking a lot of pitches, wearing out the opposing team and whatnot. So just looking at the game differently from a perspective of not the direct generation of runs, as Matt said, but outs being the key in the game, right? As long as you're not making out, you still have a chance to win, so to speak.
Sure. One of the things that I thought was very compelling that Michael Lewis wrote was really the sort of battle that went on between the scouts, who had this idea of what a athlete's body should look like.
Right.
And, you know, we are looking for these kind of superstar talents with these fit bodies, and Bean didn't care about that. He cared about the bottom line. Could they get on base or not? Whether they, you know, had a large ass,
right?
If they could do it, you know, they were
successful. Right, right. There's a pretty interesting section in the book where they're talking specifically about a player that Bean wanted to select in the draft. And I'd like to talk a little bit more about sort of talent evaluation and drafting players in sports and how it may or may not relate to more talent acquisition activities on the corporate side. But in particular, this story was really about a catcher who didn't really look the part, right? He wasn't tall enough. He was a little bit misshapen, quote unquote, right? A little pudgy perhaps, but he had a consistent record of performance at the college level that, in Bean's estimation, and through his associates' application of these analytical models that they had developed, it sort of predicted that this guy would be a success in the majors. It turns out the guy wasn't really all that successful, right? And the book doesn't really talk about that all that much, but that's slightly maybe one of the gaps in the book. And much like the A's never won the World Series, which tends to get a little bit lost in this whole book and movie, and especially now that, you know, you have Brad Pitt playing the part in the movie. But but I guess like any other talent acquisition approach or models that you have, they're not always going to work out, even if you believe you've refined your analytical model to a certain extent. But I think, Lance, I think that's a great point as well. And maybe on the corporate side, I mean, it's got to be something, let's tie it back a little bit to the workplace and the HR side, if you will. And there's got to be times when you're fighting up against that in a hiring process where the hiring managers or the organization is expecting the candidate to have a certain, I don't know, background or pedigree, if you will, and that may cause them to have some blinders to things that are maybe outside that zone?
Well, I think really one of the main stanzas of the books is the fact that, the ability to evaluate talent differently is a huge advantage, and to do it in a way, so if you, like, let's say you worked for a, you know, accounting firm and you're not in the Big Four, and the Big Four, you know, gets every blue chip, athlete out there, or accountant out there, if there's such
right.
thing as a blue chip accountant.
Right. Well, they're
the
Yankees,
like,
right? I mean, Accenture and Deloitte are the Yankees and the Red Sox, right?
Right. So, I mean, if you're evaluating talent the same way those guys are, you're going to be ending up picking guys that, you're going to be overpaying the wrong people. You're going to be underpaying the wrong people. You're never going to find that right mix. So I think when you translate talent, I think when you're looking at talent from a competitive and the draft is a good sort of like maybe equalizer to, you know, getting these guys out of college, that's the sort of thing where you can say, you know what, we can invest 20% less salary in this person, but we know that this school, which isn't very well known, actually produces better accountants in the long run, and we've tracked this. So, I mean,
right.
It's just, so I think that's one of the main things that, I mean, as far as the HR implications of that book, I think it's that they thought so differently about it and used the available statistics they had and tracked it themselves. I think that was the real, that's the real HR lesson there.
Yeah.
Did you guys see any Moneyball apps at HR Tech? Any of the companies or vendors have that sort of talent differentiator, the analytic? approach?
I don't know that I saw something like that, but I'm sure they're out there. I will say more generalized response to that, Matt, is this idea of predictive analytics in particular. We heard it in the opening, right? And our message from Acquire, and they're one of the leaders in this field, in this space as well, with predictive workforce analytics. I think organizations, excuse me, and vendors are thinking about trying to move to that next stage of not just providing tools and technologies that will sort of assemble data and crunch it around, but to help organizations, you know, obviously supplemented by organizational experience and knowledge and sort of that deep understanding of what makes us successful, right, is really critical in this. But this idea that we can take data and information on performance maybe and figure out where that's going to go. So who's likely to become a top performer? Who's likely to be a flight risk? Who's likely to and what mitigation strategies could we adopt that might prevent those things, right? Does the person need a raise? Does the person need, a bump in, more flexibility in their work schedule, whatever the case may be? I think there's a lot of energy in the space around, without getting into specific solution providers and names and things like that, I do think there's a lot of energy in that space.
Okay. One of the other interesting things about the whole Moneyball concept is how it kind of flies in the face of very traditional practices such as like retention, for example. A lot of companies, a lot of teams spend a lot of money to retain players. So, for example, my Seattle Mariners spend a lot of money to retain Ichiro. They consider that a good investment. But the Oakland Athletics let people go once they become overpriced for what their statistics show as value.
Right.
So, I mean, they don't have as great a retention. They let players go whenever they're hitting their peak performance, because that's also when they hit their peak pay. They trade players away whenever they get very valuable. So it flies in the face of everything we know. And, Paul is just relentless on Twitter about the fact that, it hasn't produced a World Series, but he's also got a point, too, where it's not about guaranteeing that you're going to win a World Series. It's about guaranteeing competitiveness, and, that's no guarantee in Major League Baseball right now. I mean, it's just there's such a it's still very uncompetitive for some of those smaller market teams. So it's about being able to get to the playoffs, and hopefully you get a sweet run or something along those lines.
Yeah,
at that point.
Yeah. You still actually have to play the games. There's still some element.
Right, yeah.
As Matt Stalick, the gambler, would appreciate this piece of advice. Some gamblers, like horse players in particular, would always say, I never bet on any animal that can speak, because there's so many variables that you'll never be able to account for. So he preferred to bet on horses. So let me do a quick reset, guys. Time is flying by on the show. I love the sports talk, and we could just carry on for all night, I'm sure. This is the HR Happy Hour show. We're talking Moneyball, talent, the tie-in between sports and HR and recruiting. I'm with Lance Hahn and Matt Stalick, to the gents from 8-Man Rotation. We got to tweet out our link to our ebook. If one of you guys can pull that up, maybe while the show's on, we'll tweet that out. Maybe some folks can have a look at our sports and HR ebook that Matt put together earlier in the year.
The link to the PDF. There it is, down a little bit. I'll retweet it again.
Cool. Our calling number is 646-378-1086. Press 1 if you want to come on board and get in on the Moneyball conversation tonight. We do have a caller who wants to get on the line, so I'm going to open up that line right now. Hi, area code 617. Do I have that right?
Steve, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Excellent. Hey, it's Shane Granger from Australia. I was wondering
it's James. It's country code 6-1. It's not area code. I misread that. Hey, Shane, how are you?
Yeah, very good. I was wondering if I could throw a scenario to the panel, and I'm really enjoying this conversation today. Sport and analytics, it's pretty sexy, actually. So
Australia's a great sporting nation. We know that.
So the scenario I want to put to the panel today is that Okay, so America's a very free age, so the kind of talent acquisition in Moneyball, obviously, and I haven't read the book, is around the free agent sort of model. In Australia, my code that I generally watch during our winter is rugby league, which actually has a salary cap in place.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the talent acquisition, is because it's been around for, you know, around a decade, a lot of that talent acquisition is actually pretty locked in. So, you know, you might spend some big money on key players around the wing or the 5/8, you know, strategic players, maybe even a key forward. They're the big guys who just run up and take hits all day. But a lot of your team are generally, you know, in the salary cap, you pay maybe 3 or 4 people an executive wage and the rest are on, I mean, good incomes, but, you know, around 25 players, maybe $3.5-4 million, you know, it all has to work out across that team. And a lot of the analytics have been done. There is movement between teams, but, okay, long story short,
sure.
There's no salary cap around coaching. So the strategy in the last couple of years is you've seen a huge movement in coaching because there is, you know, you can bring in a coach, a successful coach from another team, and they can take over the team and bring it up to grand final level very, very quickly.
Right.
Because most of the teams are generally pretty much on par, and it's a very, very close from top to bottom at the end of the minor premiership.
Yeah.
Okay. So I was just wondering, like with that sort of model and the idea there that you go for your talent acquisition around your leadership team, I was just going to float it and see what the guys thought.
Yeah. So, great question. And Lance, I'm going to distill it down a little bit into sort of investment of sort of money, time, attention. Right? Is it enough to put that money and time and value into the leadership team? And good leaders will bring up any team, really. I think it's kind of the gist of the question.
I mean, that's a good point. I think what you see is a lot of companies differentiate their culture based on this. So you see companies that do invest heavily in their leadership teams, in their quote-unquote A players, and they figure that will pull along the rest of the team no matter where they're at, and if you have a good enough team. I guess there could be another thought that you could have very good but maybe not those excellent guys and maybe spread that money out further. But I mean, I think there's definitely a question of how a company prioritizes their money. Do you prioritize it in that selection process or the coaching process or the development, learning, all of those sorts of things? And I think actually Moneyball does a pretty good job of showing exactly where you know, Oakland puts their priorities at, and
yeah.
You know, that's the way they're going to take their organization. So they're not going to pay for one superstar and then surround them with a lot of mediocre talents and hope that superstar could, you know, pull them through. They're going to try to find a lot of scrappy guys that play better than what they should be paid until, you know, if they have a breakout star, then it's like, okay, well, you know, once we can't afford you, you're going to go on and we're going to replace you with, you know, we're going to get 5 guys from the other team, from their farm system.
Right.
And start building that coaching.
Yeah, and so the Moneyball story, again, we're tying it back to the book a little bit, is a little bit almost in some levels opposite sounding on the surface of what Shane described in the rugby league in Australia, which was Bean's philosophy, you know, and the measurement approaches that they were taking to players, to drafting players and to putting players on the team and actually developing players, because the book does talk about how the philosophy starts to get instilled in the minor league system as the players try and work their way to the major league club. But the system becomes so important, and the system becomes the foundation by which the player the personnel decisions are made, that the actual manager of the team, right, the field manager of the team's importance is quite significantly diminished compared to how it is traditionally looked at in baseball. And I've heard that the movie really plays up that angle even more than the book did, and it makes the manager of the team, the field manager of the team, look a bit of a stooge at times. But it was kind of an interesting part of the book, I felt, brings at least some of the, probably some of the tension to the story as well. And that, you know, I don't know if you've seen something like this ever either, right? Is if we just recruit the right people and put them in the right roles, you know, almost like it didn't matter what the manager was doing.
Well, we can look at a couple of examples. Look at the Miami Heat and how they were built.
Mm-hmm.
You know, let's throw three of the best players together. Will they be successful in the end? And they did not win against Dallas. Or look currently in the NFL. NFL is a salary cap, and we had an employer of choice sort of model going on in the off season. You had a bunch of players that were signed, free agents, that seemed like the Eagles were getting left and right. Playing with Michael Vick for whatever reason was attractive to these players. And so instead of going out and trying to search for talent, they came to Philadelphia. And right now they're 1-3. So.
Right, right. So the results have yet to sort of show up on the field, but I guess over time. And football's a tough game, you know. And as you guys know, the eight-man rotation guys know, I'm primarily a basketball fan, primarily. I find football is you know, it's probably the most popular sport in America, but not for Steve. I'm an NBA guy, so this lockout thing, which maybe we'll talk to a little bit from the labor relations side of things, we'll hit on before the end of the show. But you know, Matt, the other thing, and I'll go ahead.
No, I was just going to say. I mean, isn't it this idea that culture and process trump that you know, the individual talents of the people you bring in? So. You know, if a person is willing to accept the culture of that organization and accept the process by which that culture that organization operates, it's better than somebody who maybe has a great talent but doesn't fit into that process or culture. So, I mean, I think going back again to relating it back to the book, I mean, Bean was willing to bypass that traditional talent model. And go for people that maybe better fit his idea of what the team should look like. And yes, it was definitely, I heard, exaggerated, but I mean, you know, maybe it doesn't matter so much if you've got the right process in place.
Yeah. No, super point, Lance. I think that adherence to the discipline, and I want to sort of follow up with the discipline. Why were they so disciplined? Why did Bean decide, right? Why did Bean and company decide a certain type of player was the player to go after? So it gets to a point, and I've seen this tweeted a couple times that they wanted us to get to, and I think it's a great idea, which is the idea of understanding what differentiates your organization from the competition and understanding what it is that actually allows you to compete and have that chance to win. I don't want to say to win, because as Paul has reminded us a couple of times tonight, the A's never actually won, right, the ultimate prize, but they were quite successful for a stretch. So, you know, this is a tough one. I'll just throw it out as a general question. And I mean, how tough is it, you know, on the talent acquisition side and even in the development side for organizations to really dig a little deeper and understand what it is that, what are those key skills or attitudes or capabilities that are going to make you win in the marketplace? Lance, is that something that you've got to start looking out for right in the sort of screening side, assessment side of the game?
Well, I mean, now you know why, I think you know why outside consultants are so popular, because I think it takes a very honest introspection to really make that determination. I think, you know, I think a lot of employers just automatically think of themselves as the New York Yankees of you know, their industry, or maybe the Boston Red Sox. Maybe they're not the top spenders, you know, but they consider themselves like world class in the way they operate. And you need to be honest about where you are in the market, what you can afford to do, and how much emphasis you can place on these sort of like different balancing factors that were kind of mentioned before. So I think, right. I mean, I think it's not an easy process. Otherwise, people would follow it. I think the reason why it's been so successful in baseball is because it's actually, when you break it down, a pretty simple sport to analyze using statistics.
Right. Yeah, I'd agree
think,
with you.
I
that's
think,
right.
I don't think that's not going to work in a company. I mean, you're talking about a bunch of white-collar workers or those sorts of things. You don't have an on-base percentage for maybe a white-collar worker, or maybe performance varies more than you could ever account for
right.
in any metric-based evaluation.
So I'll just throw this out there as sort of a what-if kind of scenario question, and Matt, you can chime in as well, Shane as well, if you're still on the line, too. So baseball, right, and many other sports, particularly baseball, and especially the methods of analysis that are described in the book, begin to get into describing, recording, and potentially crunching or analyzing, right, analytically, almost every activity that happens on the baseball field. You know, every pitch, every foul ball, every throw to first base, every steal attempt, even if it's successful or not, right? Everything is measured, right? And as Lance, you said, we don't really have on-base percentage for the white-collar worker. Okay, so but what's the parallel, or is there one, right? You know, so the two extremes, right? Let's go to the two extremes. Baseball, right? Every activity you do on the baseball field, someone's measured it, recorded it, put it on video, it's analyzed later and used, and ultimately used in evaluation and rewards processes and you know, retention processes. And then the organization, the typical organization of today, which might have an annual performance appraisal, right? That once a year event. So there's some continuum in between, right, where probably the sweeter spot for the professional world is, or even the, you know, just the blue-collar world as well. So I wonder if would the idea be to move more towards more frequent, more often, more detailed the methods of measurement of worker performance to try to get that same kind of benefits that we see in sport?
I'm going to go dismal and say, like William Goldman, the author of Princess Bride and Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, who was describing Hollywood, nobody knows anything. And despite all this measurement that we're doing, why does Boston still, with Bill James at the helm, with Theo Epstein, go out and pay $142 million for Carl Crawford? That we have, you know, here's pro sports with enormous resources, videotaped, all that measurement they can look at, players that any average employer has such limited ability to get that information when going out and trying to hire someone for the job, and they get it wrong a significant period of time. What's the local employer supposed to do with their small pool of candidates to be successful?
Right. So again, to keep with the dismal theme, you're saying, hey, you know, well, the NBA is locked out right now and they're not going to play games, mainly, and there's a lot other subtle reasons, but I'm going to say the main reason is because the owners don't know how to evaluate talent and reward talent the right way. And they've consistently awarded sort of mid-level talent ridiculously large contracts, and they know they can't stop doing it. And so they're trying to create a system that will protect them from doing that as frequently as they've always done it, right? I think that's the reason why the NBA is not playing right now.
Yeah. They're their own worst enemy.
Yeah, because they don't – because, I mean, like you said, I mean, I think it's easy to – convince yourself, I think, because we're human. Humans are still making these decisions, right? So it's easy to convince yourself that, I mean, in this scenario, I know the statistics are wrong. I just have a good feeling about this guy. And so, or
right.
you need, Paul Hebert mentioned, you know, the fact that you need better gates. So you keep a guy like Ichiro, even if it means, like, you know, pushing back you know, what you could invest in the future for, you know, another half decade because you know, you have other pressures that are also pushing those decisions. So I think one of the really interesting things about me is just how much freedom Bean had to really just destruct his team and start over again every couple of years almost because, you know, in a lot of situations where a team like Boston gets used to winning a lot and, you know, having people excited about the season and being contender, that's addicting. And there's more than just statistics playing into that. It's the ego of an owner. And if you're an owner of any team, I don't care who you are, you've got a gigantic ego. So, I mean,
right.
all of those things, I mean, play into the fact that, you're going to make some non-fact-based, non-logical decisions along the way, and that's just something you should expect no matter if you're that little accounting firm that's in the town of 50,000 people or if you're one of the big four accounting firms.
Right, right. And so, right, and Bean described that, right? I don't know if this is a real quote from Bean in the book or not, or just made the movie, but, you know, the idea of they describe themselves as the organ donor, right, for the rich teams, right? That they'd find the great players, they'd help develop them to the point where they were successful and proven players in the league. And the contract system in Major League Baseball was then and still really is such that the drafting team sort of holds the rights to a player for, I don't know, it's probably 6 or 7 years, something along those lines, before that player can actually leave of his own free will to join another team. And so Bean would either try to trade those players before they hit that point where he couldn't control them anymore or they would just leave. And but that understanding, right, we knew who we are. We were not going to be able to compete. And I think maybe the broader point for organizations or just any professional right now is, you know, the adaptation required from working in constraints, right? Because no one listening to the show's organization is probably the Red Sox or the Yankees equivalent, right, in their organization. The Yankees and the Red Sox, they just go get whatever talent they want for the most part, right, subject to the league rules. But there's really not that much holding them back from finding whoever they want to play on their team if they can convince them to come play. And most of us don't have that luxury. And so operating under the constraints of whether they're budgetary constraints, the location our company resides in, if we need people to come live and work in the same place, maybe our industry is not that exciting compared relative to other things people could be doing. And so operating under those constraints and still trying to figure out a way to survive and thrive is another, I think, key lesson from the book. Hey, guys, let me do a quick reset. We've got about 20 or so more minutes left in the show. This is the HR Happy Hour Show. My name's Steve Bowes. I'm joined by Lance Hahn and Matt Stalick, 8-man rotation in the house. We're talking Moneyball, baseball, sports, work, and everything else. We appreciate everyone hanging out with us tonight. Feel free to call in the last part of the show, 646-378-1086. Press 1 if you want to come on board. We want to thank our friend Shane Granger from Australia for checking with us tonight. Many thanks to him. Or I guess it's tomorrow morning in Australia. And So good morning. Folks out on the Twitter stream, HR Happy Hour is our hashtag. We're keeping an eye on that. There's a few folks out there tonight, and so we appreciate all the comments and thoughts on that. So I guess the last thing I wanted to hit up, guys, on Moneyball tonight, at least I wanted to be sure we talked about, was you know, we know Bean and the A's didn't ever win, right? That's pounded in the story, and Paul's been reminding us tonight, and it's true. They made the playoffs a couple times. They never got over the hump. They never won. And then soon after, relatively soon thereafter, many of their models and practices and quote-unquote innovations started to get adopted by the more, powerful teams with more resources, like the Red Sox in particular, and to a lesser extent probably teams like the Yankees, but certainly the Red Sox were probably the large market team that is more well known for adopting those strategies. So then what happens next? I think that's a key point. The book doesn't really get to it. The book ends. The book was written in 2003, so it doesn't get to the point where all that stuff starts to happen in baseball in particular, but Bean's methods are no longer a secret or a complete secret anyway. And so I'd love for someone maybe to comment a little bit about adapting when once your innovation is no longer, I don't know, proprietary to you and is sort of out in the public domain.
Well, you know, I think from my standpoint, I think it's sort of the innovation model that we've seen in tech, for example. I mean, you take a look at the innovations that have happened. You take a look at those companies that have maintained or improved their market cap over the last decade. You know, they've continued to innovate and improve on their processes. So I think a lot of the issue is the fact that it's easy once you find a way to kind of game your system to say, you know, we got this, and as soon as somebody else figures that out, then you're already two steps behind that person, because not only do they now have your technique, they also have the money to pull off and take a few more risks than you could even take, which is just a huge advantage, which I think is probably reflected the fact that the A's haven't done a ton in the last few years. So if you're one of these scrappy underdog companies, you've got to be constantly looking for that next edge. Otherwise, like I said, you're already falling two steps behind as soon as somebody figures that out.
Right. It's a bit like when you've come up with a clever, a clever pickup line, right? To use, and then then the better looking, wealthier guy learns the same line, right? With the better car, you're doomed, right? You just got the line. He's got the line, but everything else to go with it.
That never happened to me,
Steve?
Personally, but
no, that was not a personal experience of mine. I heard about that, Matt, once.
What do you guys think about that Malcolm Gladwell on sports team ownership in the same vein, that part of the reason this is sometimes difficult when we look at owners like Daniel Snyder, that this is their opportunity to be 14 years old again and build a team like in Strat-O-Matic baseball, and I'll send out the link to the article there, and they look like businesses, but they're really more like art.
Yeah,
what Gladwell was saying.
I think there's some truth to that personally, but I also think that's what tends to make guys who do what we do sometimes, right? To try to make all these parallels between sports and work and sports and talent management, or I guess sports in the real world to some extent. That weakens our position to some point, right? Because people, you could argue, well, a billionaire owner of a sport, like Mark Cuban, doesn't care if the Dallas Mavericks lose money. He really just wants to win the title, and will do whatever is necessary to win the title, which they did win, which is great. But perhaps another owner or quote unquote regular business wouldn't be able to operate with such freedom, right? Because they'd be concerned about profit and loss and things like that.
And the owners have their own set rules for talent acquisition that many other organizations outside of sports would be jealous of.
Go ahead.
I'm just imagine if we could have a draft in the real world for, as you used the accountant's example earlier, and that all of a sudden that fifth, we have the big four, all of a sudden the other 10, 12, 15 firms would get, in a serpentine draft or however you want to do it, would get to pick the fifth through 12th players, the best accountants out there, and they wouldn't all go to the top four. Would that balance it out if they had the same roles that they did in sports in the real world?
I don't want to necessarily go off that, but I think part of the problem is the fact that at least with baseball, you're not really building a team. You're building a collection of individual players, really. I think we've said that before on HR Happy Hour that baseball is a team's is an individual sport wrapped up in a team environment, and so you've got a lot of individual matchups that you deal with, but for the most part, there's not a lot of teamwork, and that's why I like the parallel with a basketball a lot more, because I think in that case you do have a lot more of those considerations, not just on production or wins above replacement or anything along those lines, but things like chemistry, things that even an owner who is an egomaniac has to take into consideration whenever they're building a team to win.
And that, to me,
seems more realistic. I mean, Moneyball is obviously a great concept, has a lot of things you can apply, but I think that's where the book always falls short for me, is the fact that, if you had to put together this baseball team in a basketball-type format, that would sometimes just be a complete disaster.
Right,
look at the Jailblazers.
Yeah. I think about the Yankees, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Remember the late 70s Yankees, which was a high-profile, high-payroll team for its day, but they were famous for 25 cabs after the game, right? They basically all hated each other. And after the game ended, 25 guys went in 25 different directions, right? That was their sort of their modus operandi when they were out on the road, but yet they won a couple of World Series together and came close to winning a third. Whereas I agree, Lance, if we're going to, you know, we're going to sort of talk about the sports in HR and sports and workplace kind of analogies, I do agree with you that basketball tends to make more sense there for me as well, because you have a lot of, you've got a tighter unit, which tends to mirror more of sort of the workplace scenarios as well, right? We tend to do our works in smallish teams, right, tighter knit teams, and this idea that to win the championship, it's not enough to have just the one great player. You need to have that whole team concept. But as I saw, and I wrote about this recently, some of the statistics in basketball show in the last 30 years, you really do need that superstar, or you won't win. You won't win the title. You know, so you can't just be about the chemistry. You can't just be about finding 5 or 7 or 12 really kind of good guys who all get along together. That's not enough to win. So I like how basketball has that tension between the star players versus the team concept. And I think you see that more in basketball than most of the other sports.
What about with teams like in the NCAA this year, VCU and Butler, though? They didn't have a lot of NBA-style players, and yet two of the top four teams at the end of the season.
Yeah, I can't, right. You're going college ball me, Matt. I'm going to defer on that one. I'm one of the few, maybe Lance is with me. I'm not a big college basketball fan. Never really. Yeah. Once Walter Berry and Chris Mullin left St. John's, that was
Chris.
That was a good team. Come on, we really want to pull the Wayback Machine out. You know, Walter Berry.
Maybe college basketball. And you know, I don't enjoy college basketball as much as I do NBA basketball. But I went to a bunch of games last year. You know, I think one of the things that is interesting about that is maybe college basketball is actually more appropriate to compare against, because the talent pool isn't as concentrated. So you've got you've got maybe very good players at some of these elite schools, but maybe the talent differential isn't worried because you've got just such a large talent pool when it comes to
NBA.
You bring that to an NBA and you've got, you know, what, 400 players. You've got thousands.
And I'll throw another one out on this too. In my sort of opinion on this, college basketball is about coaches more than it is about players, and it's really more about, because the players are inexperienced, right? They're younger. They've just played less, right, in their lifetimes.
Less, but now these days that the freshmen of 20 years ago are at summer camps and touring almost weekly.
But the influence of coaching on college basketball is much more significant than it has been traditionally in pro basketball, right? Pro basketball is about the player, right? It's about the star player and the team, you know, to some extent, but it's not as much about the coach, right?
Unless you're talking about Phil Jackson.
Well, I mean, but it's a different. All right, it's a different style of coach, right? It's a different type of coaching, a different set of capabilities required from a coach at the pro level than at the college level, right? I mean, would you say like a coach like Krzyzewski would be competitive with any team, right? With any five pretty decent players, right? It wouldn't matter. Versus say like some of the smaller teams and smaller coaches. I don't know. The college game to me just is not as compelling. You know, you don't have guys changing their name, you know, in the middle of the season and wearing numbers like 93 and 77. I find that interesting and fascinating, you know.
Well, I think Coach K and what he's able to do with Duke. And I mean, if you take a look at, I'm maybe a little bit of a Duke hater, but I mean, if you look at the success of a lot of Duke players in the NBA, you don't maybe see that talent level when it comes to taking the step at the next level. Or if you look at those VCU Butler teams, I mean, again, not a lot of maybe players that translate to the next level, but yeah, you put them in a team environment, you take into account chemistry, coaching, and all of those things. I think, maybe NCAA basketball is a better medium for talking about workplaces than the NBA, where you know, you do have a lot of maybe ego and, you know, money and meta world peace and all
yeah.
that kind
well,
of stuff.
Maybe, you know, it's a good question, right? I mean, some work depends on the workplace, I guess, right? Some work, many of our workplaces are full of big egos and, you know, odd, irrational kind of personalities and crazy after-hours hijinks that spill their way into the workplace, right? That's about, at least we think that probably happens, right? I don't know. It's a good point. I think it's a good conversation. Guys, let me do a quick reset. We just got a couple minutes left in the show. I love talking sports. I appreciate that Lance Hahn is with us, Matt Stolik's with us, Shane Granger's checked in from Australia tonight. We appreciate that. We started off talking mostly about Moneyball. We've drifted around a little bit, but that's okay. It's been fun conversation trying to tie back sports into the workplace kind of issues and think about it in that manner. I, you know my position on sports in HR and workplace issues. I think it's, you know, I just love the fact that you can sort of in real time, any given night, any given game, any given season, you can kind of see the impacts and the end results of these talent management decisions, whether it's scouting decisions or player development kinds of processes, coaching decisions, leadership changes, and seeing them played out live and in real time, you know, week after week, month after month. I mean, that's the draw to me to why sports is such a great source of information and a resource for thinking about work and motivation. So thanks that for you know, hanging out with us tonight. We just have a few minutes left. Matt, I'll throw it out to you. Just any sort of closing thoughts. If we could take anything away, say, from Moneyball or just this whole sports, you know, the sports and the workplace stuff that we talk about and write about a lot, what would be the one or two things maybe, or if you ever maybe talk to your students about this, what might you suggest that people who are sports fans think about in terms of workplace issues?
Where can you find the talent? What don't get tied down into your job description and saying, oh, this is the fit we want. You're going to not necessarily, you know, is it the best player in the draft or is it the one that fits the particular position, which is the right thing. So always be looking and not judging specifically on very defined terms.
Right. Be flexible. Know the role. Know the role you're trying to fill and what it means. Yeah, rather than just for the best talent on the board. I love it, Matt. Lance, your thoughts. What's the net of Moneyball to you, and what are the things you really think about or the most important when we think about sports in the workplace?
For me, again, the Moneyball thing is all about thinking about talent in a different way than your competitors, and tracking and monitoring those things. So I mean, I think you're touching on two things, which is analytics, you know, tracking. Keeping track of the way you recruit, the way you source candidates, the way you deal with performance in the workplace, your retention, all of those things. Understanding your goals, and then also the culture that you're creating and the people that you're bringing into your organization. I think from Moneyball, that's what I get the most out of it. That's really what I think is most applicable to the workplace is the fact that, 30 teams or 32 teams thinking the same way about, baseball talent you're not going to be doing very well if you're the lowest paid team in baseball, or one of the lowest paid teams in baseball. So you've got to do something different. And I think everybody's looking for that competitive advantage. You've got to differentiate.
Yeah, no, last super point. If you're going to recruit the same way everybody else is recruiting, but yet you can't offer all the things they're offering, you can't win. There's no way you can win that game, right? You will lose almost every time, especially in the real world and not in the sporting world. So, Lance, I appreciate that. So we just got about a minute to go. I want to wrap this up and say thanks to everybody for checking in tonight, hanging out with us, talking sports, talking Moneyball. Especially Lance Hahn and Matt Stolik, Shane Granger checked in from Australia tonight. All the folks on the back channel, we really appreciate you hanging out with us, tweeting and commenting. It's been a really good conversation out there. I haven't been able to jump on the back channel, but I'll be sure to check it out after the show. If anybody wants to call in right now, 646-378-1086. I'll open up lines for after show for a couple of minutes for anybody who wants to hang out as well. So many thanks again. Thanks to everyone. Thanks to our friends at Acquire. And we'll see you next time on the HR Happy Hour. Good night, everyone.
This episode of HR Happy Hour, you just listened to it. It was sponsored by Acquire. We put workforce analytics within reach. Acquire Insight gives you the ease of hosted software plus the consulting expertise of workforce planning experts. Start measuring the impact of your workforce investments for better talent management today. Find out more. You don't know where. You better listen. Pay attention. It's not over. Stay off the back channel. Find out more. Acquire.com/workforce analytics.
Good stuff, guys. Matt, Lance, thank you so much. It was good fun. Paul, I know I've opened up your line. Thank you, and sorry to pick on you on the back channel as well.
I only said it once.
I tell you what, you were our guy. You were our main guy running the channel tonight, so we have to call you out. Hey, and by the way, before I forget, I call you out in a positive way at HR Tech. I mentioned you by name in my panel the other day with Chris, so just FYI.
Yeah. What I do now?
I referenced your HR playing defense post, you know, from Pistful. I said,
God,
you know,
that's a long time ago.
But it was a great one, man. So
we missed you in Vegas, there, Paul. You know, it was killing me. Up until even Sunday, I was like, I could probably get a flight. You know, I was dying watching the Twitter stream. Honest, I was.
Good stuff. So, hey, anybody who's on the line as well, just so you know, the we're on the back channel, the after show, excuse me, and we're not live streaming on the internet, but anything you do say does make the recorded archive. So be mindful of that, including me opening that beverage. Probably made the back channel as well, but I don't care.
I was surprised there weren't more people on the back channel tonight.
Yeah, it was a little quiet tonight. You know what? There was no promotion for the show, but none. We set it up this morning. I didn't even have it posted until about 11 o'clock this morning. And I think we're caught up in conference land and, you know, the jet wash of everything that's been going on. So that's okay.
I'd say, Steve, if I could just say, I thought it was one of the better shows. I really, really enjoyed that. I was just...
Hey,
Shane,
appreciate it.
I've got to translate it, though. You know, I'm going to go on a bit of a road show coming up for an organization I'm starting with next Monday. And that's having to go and talk workforce planning to some really seriously smart guys, you know, engineers and pilots and whatnot. So with 20 years in the group, and you know what, if I start talking workforce analytics or, you know, start data coaching these people, the eyes are going to glaze over and everything, and I'll probably undervalue
right.
the board as a way to talk to humans rather than talk to professionals, you know. So once you get out of the HR department or the ops department, you know, you kind of lose everyone unless you can relate to something. So I think I've got to listen to this show on slow-mo or lots of pauses.
Yeah, we were diving around a bit. But, you know, it was good fun, I think. And, you know, I think I wish I had got a chance to see the movie before the show tonight. I just haven't been able to get out to it. I read the book a while ago, too, but I think it...
I heard the movie was just a hair different. They made it look a lot like, I mean, even, I think the book and the movie both kind of glaze over the fact that Billy Beane didn't create this. They were starting this before Billy Beane even came on board.
Yeah, like the movie doesn't, and the book doesn't really either talk much about Sandy Alderson, right? It maybe just mentions him. But I think that... you know, but there's great points in that book, and there's even kind of a couple we didn't even get to probably as well. Just, you know, what's it really like to fight, you know, a hidebound set of, you know, processes and thought processes and old-timers in the organization that had been there forever. I mean, Beane had title on them, right, so that he got his way, but you don't always have that. So, you know, that probably could have been somewhere we could have explored a little bit.
Well, I think, too, that we get hung up on the whole statistical side of thing, and we all get wowed by the, you know, the analytics. But the reality was what he did was he redefined what success was, and then the analytics followed.
Right, right.
You know, it wasn't about offense as much as it was about not getting out. I mean, he had players that complained because he wouldn't allow them to steal because that was high risk. low payoff.
Right, because we didn't even get to this either, right? They wanted to get paid. They wanted to go to arbitration the next year and say, I had 42 stolen bases, and I was
right.
third in the league. Because
right.
the arbitrator doesn't know anything. The arbitrator
right.
says, oh, third in the league in stolen bases, that's great. You know, $4 million, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
I have a friend who left the news industry, sports news industry, to work at St. Norbert, and used to report on the Packers all the time, and they were ruthless in cutting players. That they could find somebody cheaper who could run just as fast or even was a smidge faster, you're gone no matter how good or how strong you were in previous years.
Yeah. That's true. Right, sports is much more ruthless, right?
It's tougher to follow a team now, though. I mean, you can't. In the old days, you know, the players stayed with the team for a long time, so you could really bond with the team and the individual players. You can't do that anymore.
Yeah. You're cheering for
Laundry,
right?
A lot of that is because of, because of the structure changes of all those leagues have, and I mean, it's been a good thing for. I mean, all of the leagues. Even hockey and baseball have increased their revenue because obviously that allows for more. But that also follows the. I think.
Well,
the
to me, it's a whole paradox, right?
Yeah.
We want to root for the same guys their whole career and have them be on our teams, but we also want them to, we want them to have, a free and clear labor market as well.
Yeah.
We're not socialists, right? I mean.
Yeah.
Because is that because the American sports have been professionalized for so long? And just as an aside, I remember when I was a kid watching rugby league, when the players would run out and they'd identify the players, they used to show what their employment was. So Steve Renouf, who played the 80s, was an electrician. You know what I mean? They weren't professional. But Australian sport is now professional, big money, and, the same issues are coming in to the Australian market. Our AFL is actually in arbitration and may go on strike. Like, Steve, I've been reading your tweets about the NBA. Like, it's a very similar market now. So, but is that because of the professionalisation of the sport that's created some of these issues? I'm talking about, the identity and identifying with a team.
Yeah, well, right. There's much more player movement in professional sports in the U.S. than there ever used to be, and that's, over time the player, and that's because the players have basically unionized and won the rights to be able to move there, back in the, 50s, even before 40s, 50s, probably into the 60s, especially in baseball, right? A baseball team essentially controlled a player's rights.
Yeah.
Almost all the way, right? From beginning to end, it was very difficult for players to change teams without actually being traded or sold. And
was it Curt Flood that started that?
Yeah, it was the Curt Flood case, right? That was in the 60s, right? Or maybe was that the 70s?
Mm-hmm. He's the one that
71, 72.
Yeah.
I still think it all goes back to Jerry Seinfeld, the routine that we all root for Laundry.
Yeah, well, yeah, it is tough because most teams now, right? They'll maintain they'll try to, at least in football for sure, and basketball to some extent as well. They'll maintain that core group if they can, the players on the periphery of that core are they're just interchangeable cogs, right? Like Aaron Rodgers is not going to get cut from the Packers anytime soon, but pretty much anybody
players.
Else on that offense is fair game, right?
Why they call them franchise players.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, can I throw out a quick cheesy fact before everyone goes?
Yeah, sure.
Steve Buchanan, who was the old Australian cricket coach, so this is going back about 10, 15 years, was unhappy about the way that the Australian cricket team was fielding. He thought that it was a bit slow, sloppy and everything. So he went to America, got a baseball coach who's still with the team, I believe. And he basically came over and taught the Australian cricket team how to field baseball style. So, and the classic example, and the first thing that the commentators picked up was that the double throw. So you'd have a relay throw back to the
right.
stumps to run people out. And teams had never seen this. And, Australia had an edge for a couple of years. Now it's across every single team. Every single team does it.
Right.
That was because someone got, and I think one of the guys did mention it, brought in someone from outside and said, hey, you guys are doing this all wrong. This is how you need to do it. To the point now where, Australians look like, when they're in the field, like the professional fielders look like baseball fielders, with the long, without the gloves, but minus the gloves. But everything else is very baseball style. And that's because someone got someone from the outside to come in, have a look, and change the whole game.
Yeah.
I just thought I'd throw that out there. That's, the
that's a good take on just, like, getting other perspectives on your business, right? And not just because you think you know how to do it because it's, everybody else does it that way too, right? That's a great, great take.
Yeah, and certainly because there was so much in this show, and I've got to listen to it again, that one of the guys definitely mentioned that, and I think it's something that everyone should take away. You know, sometimes it's interesting to get someone from a different perspective, maybe an allied perspective, but a different perspective to come in, look at your business, and
absolutely,
and say, maybe you need to do that.
That's why consultants are worth so much money.
That's it. That's right, Paul. Hire Paul. All right, good stuff, guys. I'm going to wrap it up. I've got to, you know, do my my responsibility thing here, and appreciate again, Lance, Matt, Shane, Paul as well. Appreciate it all. We've got some great shows coming up. I try to end the show early enough to do announcements, and I never do. But we've got we're doing, Lance, you'll love this, Brazen Careerist guys coming on next week. Ryan, we're going to do the whole Gen
Y
again. We'll figure out another way to talk about that, and it'll be fantastic.
As long as we don't talk about Penelope Trunk.
Yeah, I'm not going to ask him. I interviewed him on the ERE live stream, and I don't know if you guys saw it, but I didn't mention it.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think I did.
I think she's absolutely lost her freaking mind. But
no, you did. You did good.
Yeah, but Ryan's an interesting guy, smart guy,
and
I think it'll be a good show. So they're doing a big social recruiting summit boot camp kind of thing, so we'll be talking about recruiting a little bit too. Then I've got Alexandra Levitt coming on the week after that. She's got a new book coming out, or maybe it's out already, and we'll talk about that. She's pretty cool. And then I've got some folks from Mercer coming on, so we'll do a big, like, hardcore, you know, HR show with the folks from Mercer in a couple weeks. So that's what's coming up on the show. So good stuff again tonight. Appreciate it, everybody, and we'll see you next time on the HR Happy Hour. I'll play us out. Good night, everyone, and thank you again.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Good evening.
Bye. Cheers.
Mm-hmm.